Coming up this week on the Course of Life podcast, our front nine takes us to the Valspar in a very emotional winner. Great moment for the PGA Tour. And on the LPGA, a recent guest came so close to her first win. Plus, I stumbled into a fascinating golf-adjacent event here in Austin, Texas last weekend. We'll tell you all about it. This week's guest, you know his voice from Sirius XM PGA Tour Radio and PGA Tour Live Broadcast. It's former tour pro John McGinnis, talking a lot about putting as well too, with our friends from Makefield Putters. Plus March Madness, chaos, Frozen Four talk, Red Sox, Yankees, and a whole lot more. When we always end with food, we're talking burgers on the grill, and all of it is brought to you by our friends at Desert Fox Golf. Mike, I just saw the Desert Fox guys got to play some golf in Mexico, a country I've only gotten to play in once, but they're out traveling, spreading the word about their brand. As you know, we are Desert Fox stands. They're our longtime partner and sponsor, feature the Course of Life. We love their phone caddy, their towels, their merch, their soon-to-be-released DJ10 speaker, Swing 8 tumblers, and a whole lot more for your game. They're basically the go-to brand that makes your golf cart experience better. If your speaker's lacking, if you need a better holder for your drink, if you need something to make your phone a little more safer when you're playing on the golf course, Desert Fox Golf is your go-to partner, so check them out. Again, our friends are at desertfoxgolf.com.
Hello, interwebs, and welcome to Course of Life. We are proud to be presented by our friends at Desert Fox Golf. I'm Michael, he's Alex. And Alex, it was the Valspar Championship at Innisbrook, the Copperhead Course, of course, the Snake Pit down yes. there in Palm Harbor, Florida. And it was a crowded leaderboard for much of the weekend. And it entered with Peter Malnati taking his first win since, 2015, I think it was?
Insane, yeah. 9 years since the Sanderson Farms victory for him. And he's one of those names, Mike, that like you and I know just because we like adjacently see him on a leaderboard once in a blue moon. But just for some preference, Peter Malnati, you know, been out on the tour for over a decade. He's only played in three majors up to this point. So he's the definition of your average everyday pro golf grinder, just trying to find those moments. And for him to get that win for the first time in 9 years with a big, big par from the fairway bunker on the last hole, you could see the emotions just flooded out and showed how much this really meant to him.
Yeah, it's always great to see a journeyman kind of find their way back into the winner's circle after such a long career. And like you said, only three majors. What, now he's a winner. He gets to play in the Masters this year.
Yeah, he could play in more major championships this year than maybe he has in his entire career. How's that for flipping your career upside down? So he was very excited about that. We know him as the guy that wears the bucket hat. He's now rocking a yellow golf ball because his three-year-old daughter loves watching him play with a yellow golf ball, and that's the main reason he's playing with it. So he's a true father and a great guy. He's been on the PGA Tour policy board for a while as well, and if he is making a pitch right now with this winner, it's just reiterating the idea that those things that Rory and Wyndham Clark were saying about shrinking the PGA Tour to 100 guys and making it even more elite than it already is are BS, because they take away amazing stories like this when a guy who was at 400-1 odds to win this week, Mike, yep. does the unthinkable and gets a win like that. Those are the unique stories that only the PGA Tour can create.
The other thing the PGA Tour can do with the large fields is have seven Kevins in the field.
Yes, wow, just, seven Kevins was it? Wow, and it rhymes too. Amazing.
It ties for the most Kevins in a PGA Tour field over the last 40 years, tying the 2012 Pebble Beach Pro-Am and the 2023 Fortinet Championship. So, yep. Alex, can you name the seven Kevins?
Oh, no. Oh, God. All right. Well, I've got a couple off the top of my head just because I've seen them on leaderboards recently. So I've got one that I was going to say. I was going to say Kevin Kisner, but I think he might have played last week. Was he in the field?
He was in the field.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. All right. I wasn't sure about that one because he's about to be full-time broadcaster for NBC in real short order. So that's one. We got Kevin Yu. We got him on there. We got Kevin Streelman, veteran who's played well at that tournament before.
Who was leading at one point during the tournament.
He was. Now I'm running out of room. Was Kevin Tway in the field?
Yes, he was.
Wow. Okay, I truly pulled that one out of nowhere. Now I'm truly out of names. I'm impressed I got 4 out of 7. Who am I missing though?
The three remaining Kevins. Kevin Doherty.
Doherty, yep, okay.
Yep. Kevin Alwyn.
Oh, wow. Would not have got that. Okay.
And Kevin Roy.
Okay, yes, I do know Kevin Roy from Instagram. Those are, yeah, I wouldn't have gotten Doherty and Alwyn. So I don't know if that's going to be beaten anytime soon. The seven Kevins is a pretty high mark for a first name record on the PGA Tour. So I think that stat's going to hold up for at least a few years.
Yeah, probably. So pretty impressive.
The other goofy thing on the leaderboard, Mike, is that I noticed is Cameron Young. They spell his name out fully, and people are asking on Twitter why that's going on. It's because there's another player named Carson Young on the PGA Tour. So they both got the C-A Young. So they just spell both their names out in full. People were asking about that on Twitter, and I'm glad I could provide the answer here on the podcast.
There you go. There you go. Everything you need to know comes from Alex on this podcast.
That's right.
The LPGA was in Southern California. It was the Fir Hill Sari PAC Championship.
Yep.
Which
you got it.
Is not spelled in any way like you think it should be spelled, and it's all in caps.
Shout out Sari PAC, legendary Korean player.
Nelly Korda takes the W in a playoff. The win catapults her back to world number one.
Nice. Okay. Yeah. I mean, she seemed pretty relieved after the win, and she'd been off for a bit. So this was like first tournament back. I saw she kind of struggled on the first day, but again, that's that sign of greatness when you can be off for that long, slowly work your way into event and then crescendo and find the right form on Sunday. Like that's what the truly great players do. So, impressive way to get win number 10 on the career for her too.
And it's so worth noting, of course, so this could be a Nelly Korda year. This is her second win of the year since she won the LPGA Drive-On Championship in another playoff over Lydia Ko in late January. So over under 1.5 majors for Nelly Korda this year.
That's a great question. I'm going to take under just because I think I'll give her one, and I think that's about it. I think Lilia Vu would like a word on defending the Chevron Championship for sure. And there's a few other players that are in great form that could absolutely take a major this season as well. So I'll take the under on 1.5. No slight to Nelly. She'll rack up the wins this season. But yeah, that first test, I'm heading out to Houston in a few weeks. It's almost a major championship season for both the PGA and the LPGA coming up.
It is major championship season for professional disc golf.
How'd you know that?
You stumbled upon this, right, in Austin when you were out and about this weekend. You just happened to find yourself at a professional disc golf major championship.
Allow me to get sentimental for a moment here, because, Mike, I don't know if you realize this, but this past weekend was the Dell Match Play Week in Austin.
Yeah.
So I was feeling a little melancholy about the whole thing. This
so you decided
been
to try
a week
to crawl into a bottle, right?
I was, and I decided to get out on Saturday. Actually wore my Dell Match Play shirt, like as a little bit of a like solo memorial that no one else cares about except me, to memorialize the event. We go to the second stop, the Austin Beer Works Brewery, and all of a sudden I see hundreds of cars, RVs everywhere, loaded parking lot, and I see signs for the PDGA. I'm like, is that what I think it is? Is this the Professional Disc Golf Association playing an event at the brewery I'm about to go to? And lo and behold, it was. So I stumbled into a pro disc golf event, Mike. I'd never been to one, never really experienced it, just, you know, anecdotally seen it on TV, but fascinating little world there, the disc golf community. It was really cool to see the best in the world, and the PDGA women play their second of three rounds. Gallery, clapping, ropes. There was a sign boy with the final group. There were caddies carrying the backpacks of Frisbees. It felt just like a professional golf tournament. Very, very unique experience this past weekend.
So on a comparison scale with a PGA Tour major, how would you, is this like 50% of the way there, 80% of the way there? Like how, with you know, where was this in terms of comparing it to a golf major?
I'll tone it down a bit and say it was about 20 or 30% of the way there to a golf major. Very intimate crowd. Maybe a few hundred people to get to go to a disc golf tournament to be watching the first and 10th tee shots. Pretty impressive. They had a live stream of the 17th hole in the brewery for the players and caddies to watch as they wrapped up their round and signed their scorecards. There were disc golf vendors like up and down. It was basically kind of like a mini disc golf convention as well while all these pros gathered. And you really kind of got an interesting look into what life is like for a pro disc golf player. I will say lots of the top players, Mike, sponsored. They got the shirt on with the logos all over the place. They got their go-to disc brand. A lot of different forms, much like you see at a professional golf event. There's lots of different ways to get the frisbee into the basket, and you saw that. So that was a very cool first time experience. Shout out to the PDGA. I'm going to make it a note to maybe get to one of those events and cover it more thoroughly next time. But I would highly encourage any golf fans out there to find a disc golf event and just see if you can hop in on a Saturday or a Sunday and attend it for an hour or two. It was an enjoyable watch on a beautiful day.
If people haven't checked out our YouTube channel recently, they should, because Alex, you've got two videos up on there that have, for lack of a better term, gone viral. Not as viral as 1.6 million views like I went.
No, not your territory now.
But it's all about bull riding, which people really seem to enjoy watching.
Yeah, I guess we're a bull riding podcast now, too, apparently, based on the success of this video, because the people clearly love seeing my day at the PBR Velocity Tour here in Cedar Park, Texas. Just, you know, sitting front row at an event like that gives it a whole new perspective. Just an unbridled videography on my end, getting the close-ups of these rides and the fighters and the bulls as well, too. Some amazing interactions between the bulls and the crowd as well. I got sprayed with dirt a few times, which I got on camera, which is quite an alarming thing to happen when it happens to you the first time. So yeah, check that out on our YouTube. Again, Course of Life podcast. You can check out our videos and shorts there. Mike's got a short up of his most recent range session. Good to see you back out there as well, too. So we'll be sure to start doing some more posting on YouTube and get some more bull highlights up there as well.
The PGA Tour is in Texas for a short little swing through the state before they head over to Augusta.
Yep.
They would have been a 3-week swing, but, you know, like you said, no more Dell match play. So
unbelievable.
You know, it is what it is. So it is the Texas Children's Houston Open, where Tony Finau, I believe, is the defending champion.
He is from the fall of 2022. We skipped this event for a year.
It was a Cadence Bank Houston Open back then.
You got it. Yep.
And, you know, he may be looking to defend, but Scottie Scheffler looking to go 3 in a row.
Yeah, that's a problem for Tony Finau right there. That's going to be a big piece of adversity is the fact that Scottie Scheffler's in the field. I just wrote the preview, actually, Mike. People were wondering where my previews had gone. I'm now writing for a site called Total Apex Sports. If you want to read the full preview, I'll be posting that link on our Instagram at COL Podcast and Course of Life Alex as well, too. But yeah, I mean, the first and last and middle sentences of the preview are, who is going to beat Scottie Scheffler? He has Tiger Woods-like odds. He's going off at 3-1 odds to win the freaking event. That's Tiger-like odds right there for the sports books. It just shows you how dominant he is. And I think, no offense, how lack of top heavy this field is as well.
Yeah. Yeah. There is Wyndham Clark in there as well. So another former major champion in that field. Will Zalatoris looking to get his form back as well.
Yeah, he contended a few weeks there for a little bit, coming off the back injury from the extended lead. But yeah, again, it's all Scotty. I mean, even I bended the knee this week. Usually in this spot, I'm looking to like pick around the massive favorite. I can't do it. He's in his home state. This is a course and event he knows well. And he's the best player in the world that just found his putter. So it's going to be very hard to beat Scotty this week. Let's see if anyone's up to the task to do it.
All right, let's switch over to Tuned In and share a little bit about what we're paying attention to outside of the world of sports. But Alex, I think yours is still mildly sports related.
Yeah, just a little news drop. Just initial vibe and thoughts from the both of us on news that a Happy Gilmore 2 is officially greenlit. This is something we've teased in past episodes before, but it sounds like it is about 99.5% official. Again, this is walking that line, Mike, where it's a movie that's regarded as such a classic. It's going to be hard to live up to, match, or exceed the hype of what's been done with the original. What's your just gut thought on what we're going to get out of Happy Gilmore 2?
I mean, it's going to be difficult because the things that made the first one great, like Carl Weathers, even though he died in it, in the movie, his character died. He's not there to do it anymore.
No resurrection. So no angel.
There's no more
scene.
Chubs.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, who is he going to fight during the pro-am?
Oh, dang. I didn't even think that far. Crap. Or it's got to be Bill Murray, maybe?
Maybe, I guess.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to have Bob Barker. And is Lee Trevino still going to pop up every once in a while and, you know, shrug at Happy and be there?
Lee Trevino is confirmed alive, so we can book him. I can confirm that one for you.
Excellent.
So, yeah, I'm very curious to see how this reiteration looks. Maybe Adam Sandler is, like, moving into, like, the mentor, like, Chubbs role for someone younger that's cast as a young Happy Gilmore. I mean, everyone's making the Will Zalatoris joke since he looks just like Mr. Gilmore's caddy. That, like, yeah, if we don't fit Will Zalatoris somehow into this movie in a weird way, we're missing the joke. So, yeah, I'll be interested to see how this rollout proceeds. Again, you know, just tainting these original golf classics and trying to put a sequel out. I know it's the name of the game in Hollywood. I'm cautiously optimistic, so we'll see what the news entails in the next few months.
All right, let's get to the turn in this week's interview. And this week we've got someone who's got over a decade of experience playing on the PGA Tour. We'll definitely be able to recognize his voice from PGA Tour Live and PGA Tour Radio. It's John McGinnis.
That's right. Yeah, who we bumped into really briefly, if you remember, at the PGA show. He was supporting a really cool putter brand that we got to try out. So he'll get into that. We talk about the details of putting and how his putting's evolved with age. And this is a guy that has awesome experience, Mike. He spent over a decade on the big tour as a player, and he has a lot of experience broadcasting both for radio and TV, which I know you'll find fascinating as well. Really cool conversation coming your way with John McGinnis. Next up on the tee, he is a decade plus veteran on the PGA Tour and now a prominent voice on golf TV and radio broadcasts for close to two decades as well. It's John McGinnis joining us here on The Course of Life. John, how you doing today?
I'm great. I didn't realize I was old enough to have been through that many decades, but I guess I have.
Yeah, you're crushing it. You got all sorts of experience, not only playing the game, but your voice is very familiar to everyone who's out there who's watched or listened to golf at all. You've been around the tour for like the last 30 years now. I'm curious, flashback to when you first got out on the professional golf scene versus what it looks like now from 30,000 feet. How much has the game and professional golf changed in that time?
The game itself has changed immensely, and then all the things around the game have changed. I mean, when I started, the TV was on for 2 hours a day on the weekend, you know, whereas now Thursday morning every week, the first shot's on ESPN Plus. You know, you can't get enough golf these days.
So
from that aspect of it, the golf is far more mainstream than it ever was. And then the talent level's so much deeper. And oh, by the way, I made $184,000 my rookie year and kept my card, finished in the top 125. What was that? Like 40th place at the AT&T this year. So, yeah, I would say the money has changed things a bit, too.
So we're going to retroactively go back and give you the new purses for those old finishes. Does that sound good for you?
That'd be just fine. I won $66,000 on the PGA Tour for losing in a playoff.
Wow, that really is insane. That gives you some showcase to how much the game has changed in the purses as well too. And one thing that we like to showcase here on the podcast is we have lots of stories with different kind of mini tour and grinders out there that are making it in professional golf that aren't necessarily on the tour. Now, you had an interesting time in your professional career getting your way to the tour in the early 90s after your college experience at ECU. I'm curious what your memories are like of that grind as well to kind of getting yourself on the PGA Tour in the first place.
Well, that's another part of that was very different. In 1991, my first Q school, there were two players who played golf in college in May and got to the finals of Q school in December. That was me and Brett Quigley. That was it.
Wow.
These you know, these days, then of course, Phil wins as an amateur the next year. And that was, or actually he won as an amateur that year. But, you know, that's how different it was. There was a learning curve, and you had to appreciate that learning curve, and you had to work your way through it. So I mean, I played everywhere. At 25 years old, 24 years old, I started in Vancouver Island, Canada, and played the Canadian tour from there all the way to Prince Edward Island, which is another time zone east of us.
Jesus.
How many Canadians have driven across Canada? But Patrick Sheehan and I did it in an old Honda Civic. You know, it was just the life that you led. I slept in that Honda Civic when I had to, but it never occurred to me that I was doing something wrong, that I was out of my mind, because we didn't know. We didn't know how hard it was. We didn't know the odds that were stacked against us. We got all the information we knew about professional golf from Golf Week and Golf World that came out once a week. And that's where we checked the scores from all the mini tours. Now, you know, there's live scoring on all those mini tours, and you can see from anywhere in the world how your favorite player is playing, and you can find out pretty quickly that you're not as good as everybody else. I think there was kind of a blessing in the ignorance.
Definitely, for sure. Yeah. And now when you see the depth and like the, you know, you and I used to know it as the Nike or Hogan Tour, but it's evolved from the Nationwide to the web.com and now the Korn Ferry Tour, you know, beyond the PGA Tour, people are starting to realize that there's another 300, 500, 700 guys that are like maybe just as good as the PGA Tour that are just chomping at the bit for their next opportunity as well, too.
Somewhere in the late 90s, early 2000s, and you can go back and look at it, there was a beer company in Colorado that put together matches between the top Korn Ferry players and some PGA Tour players that volunteered to do it. And I think they did it 3 years in a row. And I think that what's now the Korn Ferry Tour players won every year. And they're like, yeah, this isn't working out the way that we had hoped. But what it showcased is how hungry those guys were. And if you just look at the simple math of it, at 125 exempt players on the PGA Tour, there are more starting pitchers in baseball. I'm not talking about, you know, full-time pitchers. I'm talking about starting pitchers, 30 teams, five-man rotation. That's 150 pitchers, 125 exempt players on the PGA Tour. You think making it to the NBA is crazy? Well, there's twice as many of those guys as there are exempt PGA Tour players. And that's before they started shrinking things last year down to 70 exempt. So the idea of getting to the tour is a pretty daunting now when you start looking at those numbers.
Definitely it is. Yeah, obviously the game has grown immensely, and you spoke to it very well there. Again, John McGinnis joining us here on The Course of Life. Really cool, unique career highlight story. In addition to the wins that you had yourself, is you did have the opportunity to have an interesting look at a very young Tiger Woods. I know you were paired with him in the 1996 BC Open, one of his first events out the gates. I'm curious, did anything stick out to you when you first played with Eldrick?
Well, so I had played the year before in the U.S. Open in 95, and he actually withdrew from that U.S. Open trying to hit a shot out of the rough at Shinnecock early in the week. And I played a practice round. The guys from Titleist put me and two other guys that nobody had ever heard of in a practice round with Peter Jacobson, and Fluff was caddying for him. And on the day that we record this, incidentally, it's Fluff's 76th birthday, and he's still caddying. He is still caddying. But besides that, so Fluff was on Tiger's back. So I knew Fluff. I had not yet met Tiger. And the BC Open, where they play now, the Dick's Sporting Goods event on the Champions Tour, first two holes are short par fours. You lay up off the tee. The third hole is a par five. And if I busted one, I could get it out there to the corner and have about 240 to the front. And 240 was a maxed out three wood for me. I felt pretty good about it. I hit a good drive. Tiger hit a pole in the woods, hit a tree and kicked out, but it was 30, 35 yards behind my ball. And, you know, when he pulled an iron out, it was no surprise because obviously he's laying it up to a number at that point. And he made a golf swing that was faster than any golf swing I had ever seen before. And the ball made a sound coming off the club I had never heard before. And he hit it and started walking immediately. And you've got to remember at the time, he didn't weigh 145 pounds soaking wet. I mean, yeah. he was 20 years old, skinny. And the ball looked like it was going to start coming down, and it rose one more time. and landed about three steps on the front of the green and rolled to the back fringe, and he was gone. And I looked at Fluff and I said, "What the F is that?" And he said, with a smile, "That's our two iron. We hit it about 275 in the air." And I looked at him and said, "Fluff, I'm averaging 267 off the tee this year." And he laughed and said, "Welcome to the Tiger Woods era." And I thought he was, you know, I thought we were both being funny. Little did we know that two starts later, Tiger would beat Davis Love in a playoff in Vegas and make it to the tour championship that year.
Yeah, and the rest is history from there on, especially with Fluff, too. Love that pearl of wisdom from a legendary caddy in the game. And you even being a professional yourself saying that the strike sounded different, definitely a testament to how great he was at such a young age. And in terms of your career itself, you had some injuries that ended up leading you into your second career now in the broadcast space. I'm curious, what was that process, and do you remember that moment when, like, all of a sudden there was this offer and opportunity for you to just call golf instead of play it for a living?
Oh, sure. My agent called. I'd had elbow surgery, so I was in a sling, and he said they need somebody. Back then, USA Network had Thursday Friday coverage before the Golf Channel had it, and he said the USA Network needs somebody to fill in for 2 weeks. Are you interested? And I said no. He said, "Well, hang on a second. The first week is the Senior Players Championship. It's in Dearborn, Michigan. You'd fly up on Wednesday afternoon. You're on the air from 4 to 6 on Thursday, 4 to 6 on Friday. There's a 7:45 flight that'll get you home that night. They'll put you up in the Ritz-Carlton and they'll pay you $5,000. And I said, "You know, maybe I could probably fit that into my schedule."
Not a bad offer there, yeah.
Incidentally, I haven't gotten a raise since. And the second week of that, two-week stint, the second week of my full broadcast career, and the last week, as I thought, was at the Buick Open, where, of course, Tiger was defending. And on Friday afternoon, I catch Tiger on 12 and bring him into the clubhouse. That's the whole broadcast day back then. And at 5:45, he comes down from the from scoring, and he sees me in a sling, and he makes a joke about it. And so I know he's in a good mood. And Lance Barrow from CBS, who won 17 Emmys in golf, I do believe. He's in the Broadcasting Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Says in my headset, "Ask Tiger what he has to do to win the golf tournament." Now, I love Lance, and I love him more now than I did then. But this is the end of my broadcasting career, and I'm going to ask Tiger the dumbest question he's ever been asked in his entire life, before or since, I do believe. Remember, it's 2004, and I said, "Tiger, we all know you're getting married soon. How's that going to affect your fishing?" And he started laughing, and he spent the next 90 seconds talking about spear fishing in the islands with Elon, something we had no idea about. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Tiger,
a rare thanks." Candid moment from Tiger there.
Yeah. Well, every interview I've ever done with him since, and this is 20 years now, first thing out of his mouth is "straight golf, McGinnis." Or "straight golf, Johnny." He calls me Johnny. And so I've asked him nothing but straight golf questions ever since then. But I got finished with that, get back to the TV compound. They had 11 more weeks in the broadcast year, and they offered me the 11 weeks. And I took it. And I can't say the rest is history. There were some bumps along the way, but it's been a hell of a fun ride, I can tell you that.
Absolutely. Now, you've been a mainstay on golf broadcast in a couple different formats. Your voice recognizable for PGA Tour Live, Walking the Fairways, and the USA broadcast originally. But you've also done a lot of radio as well, too. I remember seeing you walk the fairways at the Dell Match Play here in Austin, Texas, and other tour events. I'm curious, I'm fascinated as well, and our audience is wondering what the difference is like calling golf for television versus calling golf for radio.
We were the first ones really doing radio over here. So we didn't know. We were sort of making it up as we went. That started in 2005, which was the second year of my broadcasting career. And I had been doing TV. And what you learned very quickly doing golf on the golf course with radio is the positioning is totally different. In television, I'm responsible for the player. You guys can see the ball. The other broadcasters could see the ball. So I'm responsible for the player and the conversation and maybe what club he hits and what yardage he has. On radio, I'm responsible for the ball. So while they're hitting second shots, I need to be up at the green to tell the listener in their car where the ball went. And so it's a different skill set, and it's a different vocabulary, and it's different positioning. You're actually spending more time with the group in front of you than you are with the group that you're calling.
Right.
Which was fascinating a couple of years ago at the British Open with Cam Smith in the penultimate group, and I'm with Rory's group in the final group, and I'm on every green while Cam Smith is putting the lights out. And so I was standing right there. I was the closest person to him when he hits the third shot on 17 and putted it around the bunker, because I'm waiting for Rory out in the fairway to hit his second shot, and I could tell people where it went. So it's really awesome doing both, because you never get bored with either one.
Very well said. And the funny thing I have to shout out too is I've seen, I think, you and some of your colleagues calling golf on the radio at these tournaments. Now, there's this little technique I see where you kind of have to keep the voice a little low when you're calling putts and things around the green. And I've seen a lot of you kind of put like a clipboard or something Yes. to protect your face from basically what's going on the course. Describe that technique. And have you ever had a moment where like a player can hear you and tell he hears you? What's that dynamic like?
Twice in 20 years, I've had players tell me they could hear me, and it's really embarrassing both times, especially if one of those guys is Vijay Singh back in the day. But it's really just to muffle your voice so that you can speak in hushed tones, but still be heard. You don't want the guy in his car having to turn his volume up so that he can hear you. And there are golf courses that lend themselves beautifully to standing 30 or 40 yards away where you couldn't be heard, like TPC Sawgrass. You know, you could always go up on a hill and be 30 feet away. But then you get to a place like Brookline, where we had the U.S. Open a couple years ago, or Pinehurst this year, where the greens are pushed up and you literally have to be greenside to be able to call the putt. Sometimes you tell the producer, I'm not going to be able to see the hole here. Tell me where it goes, and he'll actually tell you what the putt's doing as you're saying from 30 feet it's away, and he'll say it's missing on the right, came up short, and then you repeat that and go on to the next hole. It's preferred that doesn't happen, but it does.
Fascinating. Yeah, I was always wondering if the players could hear you. Again, John Kadrick and McGinnis, Kadrick and McGinnis on tap. John McGinnis joining us here, XM host, PGA Tour Live. You know his voice well from the world of golf. We actually met and got to connect quickly at the PGA show for your friends at Makefield as well, too. I wanted to quickly ask you about putting as it pertains. You're seeing the world's best putters, and you know what it's like to be out on tour putting. Explain the importance of having confidence, not only in yourself as a putter, but the actual putter you're using on the greens as well, too.
Well, for me, if I couldn't have putted, I would have never gotten out there. I thought it was funny. Early on, I was friends with Dave Stockton Jr., still friends with Dave Stockton Jr., but at Pebble Beach one year, his father was playing, and we're sitting around during a rain delay. It's a table with Dave Stockton Jr. and Sr., John Denver, Kevin Costner. I mean, it was a table, a dream table, while it's pouring outside, and Dave Stockton is holding court about putting, and everybody is listening.
Nice.
And what he said was one of the great compliments he ever got was from, and I can't remember the crusty old player that told him, you know, Dave, if you couldn't putt, you'd be selling hot dogs out there in that stand. And he said, that's the greatest compliment I ever got. So it's all in your perspective. And what he meant by that is, you know, if you can't putt, you can't play. You know, we pick on some of the best players in the game right now, Colin Morikawa, Scottie Scheffler, even JT for a period of time when they don't putt well. But they're not that bad. They're just not as good as the rest of the guys that they're playing against on those occasions. And they make up for it in other ways. And then there's the guys who make up for some of their other shortcomings with their putter. You know, I don't know which one is better. What I do know is that as soon as you start to lose confidence in what you're seeing and what you're doing with the putter, you're in real trouble. And so you have to protect your confidence. If you're an East Coast guy, you get out there on the West Coast, you putt three straight weeks on Poana greens, and you're not going to make any of those putts. You have to tell yourself, you have to forgive yourself for that and say, okay, but when we get to the Bermuda, everything's going to go in, and keep your confidence. And the other way to keep your confidence is to have faith in the equipment that you're using. And really, I was on tour when huge technology booms happened in putting. You know, the Odyssey came out with their
counterweighted
putters and the two balls and all of those things that sort of led into what is the modern putter. And I don't know if there's anything more modern in terms of shape and feel than the Makefield. I mean, it's made out of aluminum with heavy weights on the inside. So the insert feels as soft as any old bullseye that you ever putted with as a kid, but yet it has all the advantages of the modern technology. That's what I love about it.
And the idea that you can get your putter fitted is not something that really ever was on my radar, even being a lifelong golfer. But a brand like Makefield coming up with the technology to allow golfers to have a putter actually fitted to them, you know, in the way they stand, hold it, hold the grip, hold the putter, all those things are important too. So that's all kind of part of that amazing technology in the putting game, in addition to pretty much every other club in the bag that we've seen in recent years as well.
Well, and what they've done. And this I didn't think was possible. They've created a kit where you can fit yourself.
Yeah, it's awesome.
They'll mail it right to your house.
So cool.
There's a couple of shafts, a couple of heads in there, different bits. They don't bend the shaft to change the loft and lie angle. They change the shaft, or they change the tip on the shaft, which I love. It's going to stay there. I used to have to bend my putters slightly upright, and after a month, you'd have to go get them bent again because they remember where they were supposed to be. This technology is out of this world. And as I got older, I'm still a good putter. I was a great putter when I was on tour. I'm still a good putter. But yeah. As I got into my 50s, I needed a little more weight. There was a little bit of unintended movement at the bottom on occasion, and the slightly bigger grip and the extra weight on the Makefield eliminated that. I mean, completely. I didn't have to do anything else but switch to the Makefield putter, and the extra weight in it took away the jitters I hate that Y word, but I'll say it. It took away the yips.
Now, very well said, though, and that was cool to learn about that putter technology and connect with you at the PGA show. Again, John McGinnis joining us here in the Course of Life. Let's do some quick shots before we wrap up. Curious now, what does a day look like on the golf course for John McGinnis in 2024? Paint the picture for us.
You mean as a player or as a broadcaster?
Yeah, as a player. Yeah, when you got a day to yourself on the course.
Yeah, no, I love playing with the boys. I think that having a group of folks to play with, and I've got guys at home. We would meet around 11, if depending on whether or not I had a show, and play. I'll generally pay a couple of beers and then I'll go home. I play with guys that are better than me now. I actually play more on the road, especially I did a half a dozen Champions Tour events last year. And it turns out that the producer on the Champions Tour is the biggest golf nut I've ever met. And any opportunity to go play golf, and you know, we're usually done with the broadcast day at 4 o'clock. And in the summer, especially we played in South Dakota, played Calgary in the summer, it doesn't get dark until 9 or 10. So you end up missing dinner a lot when you're on the road with the Champions Tour guys, because they're going to play golf as long as they can, every afternoon they can.
That's funny you mentioned that, because I used to volunteer at a Champions Tour event when I was a kid in Massachusetts, and I used to see the broadcasters and production crew out there playing the tournament course, like before the first group even went off, or like before sunset. They're all golf addicts on that Champions Tour crew, I guess.
Yeah, they are. We can't get Lanny to come play with us, but John Cook comes and plays, and Rob Sharp and Bob Papa are golf nuts, and I love it out there. I wish I got to play more at home. We have a small business and a small child, and it just isn't in the cards every day. But hopefully that'll change over time.
I love it. Better college career at East Carolina, you or Harold Varner?
Harold had a better career. It's funny. I ran into Harold recently, and we had an interesting conversation. The question was, if we had been at East Carolina during the modern era, with the ability to transfer once people started to realize, hey, these guys could play anywhere, would we have stayed at ECU? And we both hoped that we would have. He probably won more there. He's a better professional than I was. I know he didn't win on the PGA Tour. Hopefully he still gets a chance. He won on LIV last year. He won a tournament, of elite players from the PGA Tour and the DP World Tour a few years ago.
That's right.
Down in Saudi Arabia before LIV was created. I don't know if you recall, he made like a 90-footer on the last hole.
I do remember that, yeah.
I love Harold. I think Harold is great for the game. I don't begrudge him one bit for any of the decisions that he's made. And for all of those folks who say they did it for the money, look up the Harold Varner Foundation and look at what he's doing with the money. It'll bring a tear to your eye. This is one of the great human beings in the game. And so he's a better player than me and a better human being than me.
Well said. Let's wrap with our 19th hole question. It's what's on tap with Kadrick McGuinness. This will be easy for you to answer. When you get into the 19th hole, John, what's your favorite order? What's your meal and your drink that you like to have in the clubhouse?
I'm a beer and wine guy. Liquor and I parted ways a long time ago. So okay. Depending on what time of day it is, it would probably be a beer or two. And then a nice red. I would love if I could have just whatever I wanted to with no health repercussions, it'd be a big fat cheeseburger or one of those burger dogs from the practice tee at the Olympic Club.
Yes.
Unfortunately, I hate to say it these days, it's far healthier than that. And it's very depressing.
At least you're being conscious about it, though. I appreciate it.
Don't get old. It's all part of the aging process.
Oh, stay young, John. I appreciate seeing you at the PGA show and looking forward to seeing more golf content from you on TV and radio. And hit them straight next time you get out there, right?
You too. You too. Thanks for everything.
Course of Life podcast is brought to you by Zencastr. We've been using Zencastr here since almost the very beginning as how Alex and I record this podcast from hundreds of miles away. And it provides us with great quality audio that works every time. And it's something that makes Course of Life what it is and has kept us being able to make consistent episodes every week. And now it's super easy to record a podcast with Zencastr. You log in using your browser and start recording a high-quality podcast right away. You record studio-quality sound and up to 4K video with your guests. You feel a sense of zen knowing Zencastr's multi-layered backups ensure you always have your recordings in the highest quality, even if the connection is unstable. And have you ever wondered what you actually sound like? Zencastr's post-production process makes you sound buttery smooth. It automatically removes those ums and ahs in your recording. It removes those awkward pauses in conversation too. Set the right podcast loudness and levels while reducing background noise with the click of a button. Head on over to zencastr.com/pricing and use our promo code COURSEOFLIFE to get 30% off your first month of any Zencastr paid plan. We want you to have the same easy experiences we do for all of your podcasting and content needs. Again, that's zencastr.com/pricing and our promo code Course of Life. Zencastr, it's time to share your story. We're back. Great chat there with John. Fascinating hearing him getting into putting with Makefield putters, which we got to try too at the PGA show. And you went on a little run with a Makefield putter.
I did get hot with one of those. Well, we'll get that video up in the next week or two, so people can see the unique putters that Makefield has and the unique custom fit system as well too. And that commentary, Mike, I know you appreciate on the difference between calling golf for radio and television. You don't quite think about how drastically different that broadcast is, but it's unique to hear from a guy that's got experience doing both.
Yeah, it's not something you think about what you're really paying attention to when you're calling on radio versus television or when you're listening to it, but fascinating to hear the behind the scenes. At least I always love to hear about the behind the scenes.
Yeah, stuff. Again, check out John McGuinness, Kadrick and McGuinness. You hear him all the time on Sirius XM PGA Tour Radio and PGA Tour Live as well.
And if you like that conversation with John, plus everything else we do here on this podcast, make sure you leave us a rating. Punch that subscribe button on your podcast app right now. Let's us know what you want to keep hearing more of what we're doing. And if you think we should do something different, certainly let us know. You can reach out to us on Instagram, COL Podcast, Course of Life, Alex, M-W-R-I-N-C. Alex is on X, formerly known as Twitter, Course of Life 1, or of course on YouTube as well, getting videos and stuff up there just about every week or so. And you can also, if you're not already listening to the podcast on YouTube, you can listen to the podcast on YouTube if that's a preferred method for you. No, you will not see our faces. I cannot begin to explain the amount of additional work I would have to do if we did this as a video podcast. But people are asking for it, Alex.
Yeah, well, I'm going to meet halfway with the audience, and we're going to start to get some interviews on video. So we'll get some awesome video clips and shorts that you'll see on that YouTube real soon.
All right, let's talk March Madness. It was the opening weekend, and we had some upsets. We had some Cinderella stories to start the week. We had Yale. We had Oakland. We had, Grand Canyon.
Yes, University. Grand Canyon.
And after the first weekend is over, the only one left standing is North Carolina State. Other than that, every other top seed has made it.
Yeah, frustrating kind of development for your classic March Madness better. I mean, if you got in on the underdogs on Thursday and Friday, you probably won some money. But then if you decided to double down on the weekend with more upsets, Vegas took all your money back and then some. So I was left very sullen on Sunday evening as the underdogs were not hitting Saturday and Sunday. And then my bracket was completely busted as the Baylor Bears, my champion, dethroned by Clemson. So along with all the people who had Wisconsin and Kentucky and everybody, like, there's a lot of busted brackets out there. But in the end, you're right. Yeah, a lot of the top seeds did end up squeaking through to the Sweet 16.
Yeah, I mean, North Carolina really cruised. Purdue cruised for sure. UConn cruised. Houston is cruising. So, I mean, your bracket is busted. So give me a new favorite. Who's going to win it all now based on who's left?
Freaking UConn's in the driver's seat. The defending champion looks just like the defending champion. I will say Purdue has usually been that choke all over themselves team in March, but they don't look like it. So that could be a crash course game, potentially UConn-Purdue. I'd be watching for those two. They look the best out of the gate so far.
Also, I was really annoyed, and I'm sure you were too, about how, like, every single game on Sunday started at, like, 7:30 or later.
Dude, that was so annoying. The tip-off times were really bugging me. They used to have it, if you remember this back in the day, they used to squish, like, three or four games right in a window, and what would happen is they would all finish within, like, a 20 or 30-minute window. Well, the March Madness organizers and CBS quickly got greedy and realized that they could capture more of our attention by staggering the finish. So only one game is finishing every hour. And then the tip-off times, you're right, so backloaded on the weekends. I need more early action on Saturday and Sunday. Get my engine revving early in the day and keep me entertained for the rest of the night. Don't have me waiting until 9, 10 o'clock at night to see if Yale gets ousted in the second round. And thank God they did. But yes, thank you for mentioning that. Tip-off times need an adjustment for next March Madness.
You know, it was interesting too, because I was talking about it with my wife as we were watching the Grand Canyon team lose to Alabama.
Yes.
And the screaming girl next to a microphone, by the way. Oh, my God.
So I was watching on mute, and unbelievably enough, we're over a day removed from the screaming lady. I still have not heard audio of the screaming lady. So do, Mike, please tell me, what did that scream sound like to you?
It was almost like a Wilhelm scream, and it was going off on any Grand Canyon basket, even when they were still like eight below. Like, they just, like, oh my God, it just never ended. It was pretty bad. But going back also about start times, I was bringing up how it used to be so great back in the day before we had streaming for everything. And when it was just CBS carrying the games, because you'd get in that 20-minute window like you talked about, and all of a sudden, CBS would just start jumping to every single game in the last 2 minutes.
I forgot about that, because all these blowouts, were the favorites up 30 points. I don't need to see the last 5 minutes of the game. You can take me right away from that game. You can shoot that game into the stratosphere. I never have to see a whistle from it again, and send me to the game that's more exciting. And yeah, that aspect is missing as well.
The one nice thing I will say is that I do, you know, I don't have cable, but I have Paramount Plus, so I get CBS, and I have Max, so I get TBS, TNT, TBS. So I was able to, at halftime of the Grand Canyon game, jump over to Clemson and Baylor and watch the end of that game, and then jump back and watch the end of the Alabama game as well, which was just a horrible game.
Yeah,
it was close, but it was horrible.
I was giving a lot of people anxiety on social media is what I saw.
Yeah, it was rough. It was pretty rough.
Yeah. Bracket busted is the headline for me.
Can we talk, though, about, speaking of brackets being busted, about these coaches that are coming out and saying that the mid-majors and small majors should not get automatic bids into the NCAA tournament anymore?
Whoa. Hold up. We need that. We're part of the percentage of people that needs that bid.
I know. It's just like, it makes no sense to me why this is what these guys seem to want.
It's the elitist. Done. They want the whole Big 10, the whole Big 12, and the whole SEC in the tournament.
Yeah, they're getting really annoyed that they can't win. Tom Izzo wants to do it, of all people. That he's tired of losing to Nevada, George Mason, Memphis, yes, and Middle Tennessee.
So, that's the real headline. Yeah.
It's elitism. It's dumb. It's the whole reason why the tournament has become so popular and so fun to watch is because of those upsets that come from these schools that you don't think are going to do anything.
Oakland wouldn't be
in. Grand Canyons, from Yale, from Oakland. Yeah, exactly. These schools that you don't think are going to win, and then they go on a Cinderella run. So
St. Peter's, case in point, coming out of Quinnipiac's conference last year too.
Yep. So anyway, we do, speaking of heartbreak and everything that comes with it, mid-majors, I'm going to give you 30 seconds to talk about how upset you are. Like Quinnipiac, we lost our conference tournament. We didn't even get to the finals. And again, so we got into the losers tournament, right?
Yes. And so the NIT, a.k.a. the not-in tournament, is for the losers who don't get on the bracket. We didn't even make that, Mike. We got into the CBI, which is for the losers who can't even qualify for the NIT.
Yeah. And how'd we do?
And we lost to Evansville University in Daytona Beach, Florida, of all places. The most sad, anticlimactic ending you can have to one of the most promising seasons in our alma mater, Quinnipiac University men's basketball program, in maybe a decade. A little bit of a solemn end for the Bobcats there.
Well, I got good news for you. We're back in the NCAA ice hockey tournament. Yes. The defending Division I men's ice hockey national champions.
Thank you.
We are the overall number 9 seed in the tournament, which means we get the right to play Wisconsin to open the tournament.
Okay.
I think that's on Thursday or Friday, I think. And then we get to lose to Boston College.
No, not losing to Boston College. We're going to be that Cinderella. We're going to do it from the back of the pack this time. We're going to shock the world. We're going to beat BC just like we did last year. I'll take none of that, Mike. I'm not here for that. I'm also dying from all the losers from the past weekend, so I need to latch on to a winner immediately, and I think this is my new cause this week, is the Quinnipiac ice hockey team.
If Quinnipiac makes it to the Frozen Four, are you going to go? I think it's in Minnesota.
A bit of a commute there.
That's what a plane's for.
Yeah, seriously. Minnesota, not quite the destination I'd love for a Frozen Four, but I would love to see them make that happen. It's going to take 2 wins, though, so that gets going later this week.
All right, let's talk baseball, because it's opening week. It's happening. Finally, we made it, Alex. Baseball season is here. My Yankees heavily favored to go deep into the postseason and maybe even play for the World Series. How are your Red Sox looking, though?
It does not look good by any stretch of the imagination. I think I went on a similar rant at this exact time last year, and I was wondering how they'd get to 500. They got somewhere in the neighborhood of 75 to 80 wins, mercifully. I don't even know if that number is going to be eclipsable. They did next to nothing in the offseason, and there's just a lot of other priorities with ownership that have us believing that the Red Sox aren't priority number one in terms of investment. So it's a daunting outlook heading into the season. The only thing I have is just like, are we just that random dark horse team? Because there's always one that just comes out of the pack and surprises. I don't think we are, but like, I'll just hold on to that hope until it's not available anymore.
Are you this season's Tampa Bay Rays, Baltimore Orioles?
Sure. Pittsburgh Pirates came out of nowhere back in the day with Andrew McCutchen. We're just suddenly good. I'm kind of going for those vibes. really beyond Rafael Devers, there's not a lot of name recognition in the lineup, and the rotation shaky at best. So someone new is going to have to rise for the Red Sox to do anything near contend in the AL East this year.
Yeah. Well, hey, let's talk about baseball's bigger news story that seems to be eclipsing everything right now. And that is Ohtani's gambling interpreter.
Yes. Or was it him that was gambling?
Or was it? And what was he gambling on and all this fun stuff? And was it, did he send him money or was the money stolen? I'm so confused by everything going around in this. It seems to be a different story every day.
Ohtani, yeah, I mean, the original headline was what the interpreter had, but a debt that was gracefully paid by his friend Shohei Ohtani.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And now the story is that the money was actually stolen from Ohtani.
Interesting.
But I mean, it's such a mess. The thing is, of course, we don't know. It doesn't seem like any of this gambling was done on baseball, right?
Allegedly.
If gambling was done on baseball, Ohtani will never play the game again.
It's quite literally like a Pete Rose type of incident.
It really is.
If we directly find it was him, I don't feel like we're ever going to get that link to say like, yeah, Shohei Ohtani logged into this website with the username Shohei123 and the password Ohtani and placed these bets. I don't really know if we're going to ever get that smoking gun. But time will tell on this. This is a juicy story. And the fact that the story kept moving and the goalpost kept moving only gives it more intrigue. Yeah. Of course, it being like the preeminent star in the game adds some juice as well. I'm following on this one because I think there's a lot more breadcrumbs in the trail here in the next few weeks that we're going to find.
Yeah, we are, of course, recording this on Monday afternoon. There's a news conference, I think, with Ohtani coming out later today. So by the time everyone is listening to this on Tuesday or Wednesday,
he'll be what, locked in jail? Then?
Well, who knows? I'm not going that far yet. But for now, let's hashtag always end with food.
Yep. Food segment to end the podcast. Our 19th hole content is right here. You can follow us on Instagram at always end with food. Real simple question, Mike. It was a 70-degree day yesterday with my dad over, hitting chips in the backyard, and we decided to do burgers on the grill. Mm,
nice.
I was no cheese just because we completely forgot to have cheese. I went lettuce, tomato, onion, mustard on the bottom below the meat patty, onion also below the meat patty as well, lettuce and tomato above, topped with ketchup on the top bun. What's your go-to burger on the grill order?
Yeah, in the order on the bun, my entire like stacking order.
Yeah, stacking order. Give it to me.
Okay, so it goes mayonnaise on the bottom bun.
Okay.
Lettuce pickle.
Oh, lettuce pickle.
It has been dried out a little bit on a paper towel, so it's not sopping wet.
That's smart. Good tip.
Burger, grilled onions.
Thank you. That's a big contentious point on our podcast is grilled onions. Yep.
Ketchup, mustard. Oh, and there is cheese on there, I should say. There's cheese on there somewhere. On top of the burger patty, of course. It's not like sitting somewhere in a weird spot. So grilled onions. I don't usually do tomato because I don't have any sitting around. And then ketchup, mustard, usually yellow mustard. If I have it, a sweet pepper relish.
Nice tip.
We'll go on there as well, and then top bun.
So I feel like relish is a forgotten condiment these days. I feel like relish was a bit more popular 20, 30 years ago than it is now. I might be off base there, but I don't see much of it these days.
And this sweet pepper relish was one that for a long time I only found in New England, and then happened to find it in Publix after moving here after a while. And I was like, oh, wow, I'm getting that now. So.
And double shout out for relish fans. The red pepper relish at Jersey Mike's hits very hard on a sub. So if you're there next time, be sure to try that out. That is our always end with food segment to wrap this week's Course of Life. For Mike, I'm Alex. We'll see you next week.